Welcome to Voices, the EISA podcast, the space for cutting-edge research in the discipline of international relations, and the audible companion to EISA, the European International Studies Association. This podcast sets the stage for deeper insights into award-winning papers, books, and theses, as much as it provides a room for the critical engagement with key concepts in political and sociological thought. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible. Please welcome our today's host, Polly Pallister Wilkins, political geographer and associate professor at the University of Amsterdam and board member of the EISA.
What is China's role in the global economy? To answer this question and more, I am joined this episode by Johannes Petri to discuss China's economic power and what this means for how we think about global financial circuits and growing economic contestation. Johannes Petri is senior researcher at Goethe University Frankfurt and the principal investigator of the DFG-funded Financial Empire Research Project, which analyzes China's growing financial footprint in a world of growing geoeconomic contestations as part of a larger process of empire building. Welcome to the Voices podcast, Johannes. Thank you for joining us today. Now, we hosted an episode a few months ago on the waning financial hegemony of the US, and this episode is something of a follow-up to that discussion through focusing on the increasingly important role China plays in the global economy. So with that in mind, this is something of a softball question to start. But what is the current state of play in terms of China's rising economic power?
So I think for a long time, we talked about China as a rising power. And now there's a realization that China actually has risen and it's there and probably won't leave that soon. And now we're feeling the impact of China, like properly. I think you felt it in other parts of the world earlier, but now, like even in the West, we kind of really feel that full force of when 1.4 billion people are actually starting to catch up technologically and other areas as well. And we saw this kind of transition from China first being perceived as this kind of factory of the world where everything was made to becoming a very important consumer market for the largest consumer market for, right? I mean, cars and mobile phones and whatnot, any type of commodity really. And now China actually has become this kind of incredible hub for innovation as well, which starts to also kind of frighten Western countries much more. I think it was just yesterday that Zhejiang University in Hangzhou, which is a city close to Shanghai where Alibaba was founded or is headquartered, they overtook Harvard in the Nature Index. And now in the Nature Index, 9 of the top 10 institutions are Chinese. Right, it's only Harvard that's in the top 10 and not even top number one anymore. You see that with patents as well. You also see it with royalties in that now Western firms are increasingly paying for technology from Chinese firms. So it's not just kind of empty patents, actually stuff that Western companies will pay to use for, So I think that's something that we see. In some areas, they're kind of way ahead. If we think anything on green technology, be it batteries, EVs, solar, wind turbines, they're really kind of leading by a distance. And there's this kind of really interesting thing we see in Germany, which also causes a lot of anxiety, rightly so, I guess, in that Germany used to be the car manufacturing nation of the world, and now German car manufacturers are closing down their plants in Germany. Some of them are actually being bought by Chinese EV companies, like Xiaopeng is actually considering buying one of the factories of, I think, Volkswagen, But I say, oh, it's a bit dated, which is quite interesting. And then the other side, the German firms are actually doubling down on their China investment. So if they are producing EVs, they might produce them only for the Chinese market, because now the notion is that if we're not in China, we've basically lost the car race for the future. So I think this is stuff that we see increasingly. And it's been in the making for a while, but now I think we're feeling the kind of full brunt of that, especially in Western economies where we always thought we'd be technologically more advanced than China. But that, I think, in a lot of sectors is no longer the case.
Fantastic. Now, I think many people by now are aware of China's Belt and Road Initiative focused on physical infrastructure. But importantly, in your work, you've paid attention to financial infrastructures when researching China's economic statecraft. Can you tell us more about these financial infrastructures and why they matter?
Yes, so I think it's important to keep in mind that when we talk about the Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI, there's actually five connectivities that the state that the Chinese state formulated as goals, right? I think it's kind of policy, people-to-people exchange, trade, infrastructure, and finance. So financial connectivity is actually one of the main goals of the BRI. And partially it is because a lot of things that are being built have to be financed somehow. So while we kind of often focus on the physical infrastructure, but it's much more impressive, what I studied in the past is looking at the role of kind of Chinese exchanges in creating capital market infrastructure as a kind of one subset of financial infrastructure. And there we saw that the Chinese exchanges, which are themselves kind of state-owned entities, belong to the regulatory apparatus. You basically saw these ideas filtering down from the kind of state council, the government level, towards the regulators that created a vision and action plan for how they should contribute to the exchanges actually doing that themselves, and then investing in becoming the largest shareholders in the exchanges in Pakistan, in Bangladesh, and in Kazakhstan, for instance, with varying success over the while. But we could, for instance, see that now in Kazakhstan, in the Astana International Exchange, they have this kind of growing RMB market segment where companies list BRI bonds, for instance. Now, the first Chinese company has listed actually on the AIX to raise capital for its local expansion, which is kind of linked to the BRI. So that's kind of one aspect. And there's kind of different other types of getting Chinese investors to invest in certain companies, kind of matching platforms for investment. There is kind of other capital market connectivity that's being introduced. That's kind of the capital market side. Then there's the whole kind of banking side to it, where now we increasingly see Chinese state-owned banks like Bank of China, ICBC, becoming more active in financing projects along the BRI. So it's no longer just China Development Bank and China Exim Bank, but a broader set of actors. And we see this kind of internationalization of Chinese banks creating branches and subsidiaries in the rest of the world, especially in the Global South. So there's kind of certain countries in the Global South where there's actually very few Western exchanges, but quite a lot of Chinese exchanges. So you see kind of very different kind of credit spaces emerging. We have a whole payments layer to that, so that the kind of SIPs, the cross-border international payment system that China created as an alternative to SWIFT and CHIPS, basically, has grown quite a lot in recent years. It's still kind of small compared to the US counterpart, but it's been growing kind of rapidly. And now you have ever more kind of international members that are kind of part of SWIFT. So I think Standard Bank in South Africa, for instance. Right, so you have kind of all these different infrastructures that eventually kind of help and support the physical aspects of BRI. And this, I think, becomes even more important now in that BRI itself is changing. BRI used to be about mega infrastructure projects financed by these basically two development banks in large parts of the global south, and it was US dollar denominated, a lot of these loans. Also because it was a lot cheaper back then because of quantitative easing. It was very cheap to lend in dollars, and there was no need to do it otherwise, and no demand as well, because even if China wanted to loan in RMB, the counterpart had to accept that, and they preferred dollars. And what we saw is that kind of these four dimensions have changed. So what we increasingly see is BRI is moving away from these big infrastructure projects towards there's more focus on kind of productive capacity. We see the internationalization of Chinese companies, both SOEs, but also private ones. Think of BYD or CATL expanding in Hungary, in Thailand, in Malaysia. Big kind of nickel mining in Indonesia, for instance, which is a joint venture between Indonesian and Chinese counterparts, essentially bringing Chinese technology to kind of process the nickel on site and then export it afterwards. So you see a lot of kind of more technology intensive things happening along the BRI. And with that comes a very different kind of need for different infrastructures. So now that Chinese companies do operate along in those countries, basically utilizing the infrastructure that had been built before, payments become much more important, kind of cross-border settlement, FX transactions, also kind of capital market financing, so maybe raising local bonds, local currency bonds, and so on. So kind of the type of infrastructure is changing that we see, the type of financial infrastructure, just because BRI itself has been kind of changing towards more driven by less infrastructure, more productive capacity. It's concentrated in a different area, so it's a lot more ASEAN, Middle East, Eastern Europe. The sectors are quite different, so we now have much more kind of green technology or green transition, minerals that are kind of part of that, I think nickel, copper, and so on. And it's much more kind of based RMB denominated, partly because it's now cheaper to lend in RMB, to borrow in RMB than it is in dollar. And also because we saw this increasing weaponization of the global financial system or the US financial system, dollar financial system, by America, that now we see these moves towards de-dollarization in a lot of countries around the world, especially since 2022. And China is a big beneficiary of that, in that countries are converting their BRI bonds that were in dollar into RMB, like Kenya did that, for instance, just last year. So I think, yeah, there is this kind of whole financial dimension of BRI that is becoming ever more important as BRI becomes more complex.
That leads me nicely on to my next question. And so China's economic rise, you have argued, has led to contestation and a new geoeconomic order. Can you talk us through this contestation in more detail and how finance has been and is being weaponized by different actors?
Okay, right. So we saw kind of China's rise. And within the kind of liberal economic order, and it benefited, was probably one of the countries that benefited the most from that order, even though they didn't quite play according to those rules. And we saw a lot of kind of backlash against that, also in countries around the world, especially also countries in the global south, were actually increasingly wary of kind of China's growing influence, because China's industrialization also led to deindustrialization in parts of the global south as well, just because China was became such a big economic actor. Now, the US, what we saw increasingly is that, especially with kind of the first Trump presidency, the US trying to push back against China, basically in a way abandoning that liberal playbook, and really imposing more restrictions. We saw that with the first trade war in 2018. We increasingly also saw that in the area of finance. So from I think 2020 onwards, we had these kind of, 2019, 2020 onwards, we had the investment bans on kind of a lot of Chinese companies. So, and was always kind of packaged along either human rights or national security. But the discourse in Washington was very often about we need to counter China, essentially. But they needed to find a legitimation for that in a way. So first it was Xinjiang and human rights, and then it was national security and companies linked to the People's Liberation Army. And now a lot of companies are on that list that, well, whether they actually have close ties to the Chinese military could be probably debatable. But kind of used as these vehicles by the US to kind of hamper China. We saw that with the CHIPS Act, which was probably the most kind of incisive policy action along those lines. But now there's kind of thousands of Chinese companies that are blacklisted by now by the US. Of course, I mean, sanctions were imposed on kind of other countries, often Chinese allies like Venezuela, Iran, Russia, for kind of various reasons as well. But we especially see that the kind of US-China relation that the US increasingly tried to kind of weaponize its centrality in global finance to counter China. Another example for that is the forced delisting of Chinese SOEs on the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ as well. Because a lot of the Chinese SOEs, especially the telecommunication companies, they listed in New York, raised a lot of money there. I mean, it was in 2014, Alibaba was back then the world's largest IPO. And we kind of moved to a place where a lot of the IPOs of Chinese companies are now being done in Shanghai or in Hong Kong, because basically the Americans, government was really trying to restrict their access to U.S. capital as well, in that U.S. capital should not support this kind of non-liberal economic system.
I had no idea about Alibaba, but that's amazing. I mean, you know, you learn a lot doing this podcast, I have to say. That's a great quiz question, actually. Really nerdy quiz question, but like in 2014, which was the...
Yeah. And amazing. Before that was PetroChina in 2007.
So there you go. Okay, so considering the current geopolitical context, and we are recording this the day after the US and Iran supposedly have reached an agreement, so things are in a state of play and things may change, but I still want us to focus on this. So this current geopolitical context, with the US and Israel's war on Iran and the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, if it's going to reopen or not is still slightly unclear. And of course, we had a recent podcast on the geopolitical situation in the Gulf. But what does our current sort of global predicament mean for China's role in this very now very global economy?
So I think that the developments that we saw in that war really kind of are part of that longer trajectory that we saw under the second Trump administration, in that China suddenly becomes a much more kind of reasonable person in the room, essentially. Right, we saw that with Liberation Day last year, where suddenly we had this kind of erratic tariff, this kind of very erratic tariff imposition on everyone, essentially. And the kind of coup in Venezuela, and now that war, in that increasingly, like, can you actually rely on the US as a partner, be it political, be it economic? I mean, we have all this discussion in Europe about becoming more strategically autonomous, also from the US, not just China or Russia. And I think China kind of actually benefits quite a lot from that. So there's kind of saying that if your enemy destroys itself, you just lean back and just don't do anything. That's kind of what we saw from China over the last couple of months. Yeah.
But do you think, I mean, I know we shouldn't ask, and it's terrible when we get asked this as social scientists about the future, because we don't study the future, right? We're like, we're not we're not a magic eight ball. But do you think, you know, long term and also strategically, this will have an impact on China's position in the, I mean, not just in the global economy, but also more strategically in terms of its place in the political world order?
I think it will. I think we already saw it with kind of China has been kind of leading all these different initiatives, like the Global Civilization Initiative, Global Defense Initiative, portraying itself kind of as the kind of paragon of kind of a green transition, expanding the BRICS, of which kind of China was a main driver in that process, establishing the AIIB, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So I think we've already seen kind of China building institutions that as alternatives or complements or in parallel to existing more kind of Western-dominated institutions globally. AIIB, New Development Bank, you name it. And what China, I think, was lacking for a long time was, why should people kind of use those alternatives if you have a functioning World Bank, etc.? But I think increasingly we see, as the US becomes more unreliable internationally, I don't think China wants to kind of take over that mantle of becoming a global hegemon, but I think its influence definitely has grown just because of other countries relate towards China and the US. So I think, yeah, what we saw kind of the Iran war, no matter how it ends now, I think China will come out strengthened.
A sort of accidental hegemon. because the US has dropped the bag. All right, finally, and it's also, you know, started to sort of maybe discuss this. Finally, your current research is looking at China's process of empire building. Can you talk us through how thinking in terms of empire is useful analytically for understanding Chinese economic and financial power, and what this emerging Chinese empire looks like?
Yes, I think that kind of really kind of connects nicely to what we just discussed, because so this is part of a kind of research unit funded by the German Research Foundation, where we have kind of eight different projects that adopt the same framework, which we call the Learning Empire, across different policy areas. And the idea for the project was really to say, hegemony doesn't really help us understand China, or existing theories don't really help understand China's role in a changing world. I mean, conceptually, right, if we talk about a hegemon, usually we only have one hegemon per level of analysis. We can have one global hegemon, one regional hegemon, but we kind of have two regional hegemons. That kind of doesn't really make sense. And a lot of the debate about kind of hegemony in IR discourse is about kind of, is this a benevolent hegemon, provision of kind of public goods, in how far it's very kind of based in kind of an interstate order, multilateral institutions are created by the hegemon, then used by everyone. Of course, that actor benefits, I mean, it has certain benefits from that, right? But that's kind of how this is theoretically how we talk about hegemony and multilateralism, or kind of a rules-based or international liberal order. And we argue that what we see in China is kind of two aspects. One is we see a capacity for kind of adaptation and learning, in that China has risen so dramatically. I mean, within a generation, China was kind of non-existent on a global stage, and now it's kind of the second largest economic power globally by a distance. And some things really went horribly wrong in that process. Some things worked out well. There was also a lot of feedback by the international system, i.e. the US becoming more interventionist as a result of China's rise. Yes, so we kind of have these kind of different developments that we argue trigger a process of adaptation within China, in that maybe it's not a good idea to have all this kind of policy bank lending that's on two balance sheets, and then nobody can pay us back. So now there's kind of different mechanisms of how financing could function along the BRI, for instance. Or maybe it doesn't make sense to borrow in dollar because the dollar system is becoming weaponized. So we have an incentive to actually push the Chinese banks to lend more in RMB, for instance. So that went up from, I think, 20 to 50% over like the last 8 to 10 years. So we have kind of these kind of this learning process because we have this literature also in on kind of China's political economy that focuses on kind of policy experimentation and all of that. So this is nothing kind of new. What we argue is that we see in terms of the international practices that China adopts as a result of that, we argue have a quality that we would define as imperial. So what we mean by this is it's definitely a kind of a power relation that we see emerging, but it's not really hegemony, and it works through different mechanisms. We kind of have these kind of five different imperial practices that we look at. And these are kind of both accidental and deliberate, really depending on kind of the different policy areas. We see a kind of construction of economic centrality, so be it through infrastructure, global value chains, or kind of networks. We see the cultivation of local intermediaries in that if BYD creates this mega factory in Thailand, there's local politicians that help them do that, or kind of local banks that help them in the financing and so on. So a bit like kind of this idea of compradores that we had from other literatures. The third one is that we see divide and rule practices, so heterogeneous contracting, in that we don't have multilateralism where everyone follows the same rules, but we have a lot of these kind of bilateral dealings, and then which gives a lot more power to the more powerful actor in the rather asymmetric relationship that we see. So this kind of hub and spoke system. Importantly, I mean, this is not this kind of concept of empire. We use it to understand China, but I mean, if we look at deal making under Trump, that kind of is exactly that, right? We move away from multilateralism towards this more kind of bilateral negotiation that can be much more easily used to the advantage of the more powerful nation. Then there's what we call ideological binding, which is essentially kind of a soft power element, and that is always a discursive legitimation of the imperial project. Think of the Global Civilization Initiative or Shared Future for Humanity and so on in the Chinese case. And then there's a threatened use of force as a kind of fifth element that we see in the case of China as well. So these are kind of the different practices, and we look at those practices, and what they do are they are meant to achieve autonomy for China, especially in a world that is becoming more hostile. But they also create dependencies with the peripheries. So now we might see what we see in Southeast Asia is essentially we have tariffs on China, right? We see Chinese companies actually migrating to Vietnam, to other ASEAN states, and they actually become more central in supply chains now. And now they dominate these supply chains. So if we look at kind of a lot of the kind of industrial structure in that unharnessed change over the last 10 years in ASEAN, we actually see that this is becoming much more Chinese dominated, for instance. So that would be one example of this kind of economic centrality that is being established also as a result of that kind of pushback that we see. Yes, so that's kind of how we understand empire and why we think it's actually a useful kind of concept to analyze how global economic order is changing over time and how to make sense of countries such as China, because rising power is really kind of very empty analytically and doesn't really help us understand what's happening, or hegemony doesn't really make sense either.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. I think that's something for us to take away, that hegemony doesn't make sense when we think about China and its current position in the global order. Thank you very much for joining us today, Johannes. This is our last podcast of the academic year. We will be taking a summer break after this. Our listeners will hear us again in September, so we would like to wish all of our listeners a lovely summer holiday, or not summer holiday if you listen in the global south. I should not be so Eurocentric and global Northern Hemisphere hegemonic about this. But we wish everybody a lovely break, those of you who are taking it, and we will see you all again in September. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Please find all information on today's interview guests and host in the show notes. Voices, the EISA podcast, is available on all established podcast platforms. If you liked it, subscribe now. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible.